a huge part of pulling off BRRRR correctly. Why is it important to find a lender before you start? Can't you just find someone during the process? Well, maybe. You might. It could definitely happen. Or maybe it won't. The fact is, the less you know about lending standards, practices, and the business, the less confident you should feel about getting a loan in a last-minute fashion. The truth is, for all but the most experienced investors, the lending process remains a great mystery. Most people have no idea what bankers are looking at, how they think, or why they think that way. But most people don't have this book to help them out, and you do. I'm going to help you get into the mind of a lender, understand why they ask the questions they do, and how you can stack the odds in your favor when it comes to obtaining financing. Remember, in the beginning of the book, we talked about the ways to increase ROI. The easiest method was to reduce the amount of capital you leave in the deal. You can't do this without pulling capital out, so obtaining financing becomes really important. Getting the loan and asking the right questions. As a realtor who works with buyers, the first thing I always do is to get them pre-approved. A pre-approval letter is a verification from a lender that they have taken a look at your finances and believe they can give you a loan for a specific amount. Lenders collect things like tax returns, W-2 statements, pay stubs, and credit scores in order to issue a pre-approval. Pre-approvals are crucial when writing offers to purchase a home when you'll be using a loan, because it lets the sellers know you are serious and actually able to obtain financing to close the deal. Buyers are reluctant to obtain this pre-approval and want to start looking at homes right away. This is a bad idea. Looking at homes may be the fun part, but obtaining the financing is the important part. We should always start with what's most important. As an investor, if you can't get pre-approval for a loan, that should tell you right away you are not ready to BRRRR a property yet. If this is the case, you should look at flipping or partnering with someone else who can get the financing. But most of us have no idea if we'll be eligible for financing until we talk to the lender. The good news is that if we are not eligible for financing, most lenders can let us know exactly why and what we can do to fix it. In this case, knowledge is power, and having someone show you the path you'll need to walk to achieve your goal may be all you need to get there. In most cases, you are going to reach out to a lender and ask them for a pre-approval letter. The lender will ask you a few qualifying questions over the phone and then send you a loan application to fill out. They will usually also send you a list of items you need to acquire for them: taxes, pay stubs, etc. My advice to you is to open a file in your email and save all the electronic copies of the forms you'll be sending them. In many cases, one lender will turn you down and you'll need to reach out to another. When this happens, you'll already have all the necessary files saved in this folder, and it can be as simple as forwarding them to the new lender's email address. If you're anything like me, you have a horrible time remembering usernames, passwords, and confirmation codes required to sign into the various websites where you'll be collecting this information the lender needs. Putting it all in an email and saving it in this same folder can save you a lot of headache in the future when you need to log into your company's HR website or your H&R Block account to get required paperwork. Do yourself a favor and make it easier on yourself. If everything goes well, your lender will send you a pre-approval letter stating what you are able to borrow. There are several things you need to make sure you cover with your lender so you don't end up in big trouble. Some of the big ones are how much you are able to borrow, pre-approval amount, what the current interest rates are for investment property, how long the seasoning period is before you can borrow money against the property, how long you need to own it, what your LTV, loan to value, will be. what your closing costs will be, how much it will cost to buy down the rate, what is your cash-out refinance rate, does the lender work with out-of-state investors? Now, let's break down each category for a deeper understanding of these questions. Pre-approval amount. The pre-approval amount is the actual amount of money a lender is willing to let you borrow. Lenders base this amount on the level of income you bring in compared to the debt you hold. This metric is referred to as the debt-to-income ratio. Lenders will look into how much money you bring in versus what debt you are responsible for paying, and will come up with a monthly payment they believe you can afford. Once they calculate the amount of money you can safely borrow, they will issue you a pre-approval letter stating this amount. This letter is provided to the seller of a home when you write an offer so the seller can know you are serious and are likely to be approved for the loan you are requesting. Now, keep in mind, this is what the lender feels you can afford to pay. It doesn't mean it's what you actually should borrow. It's your responsibility to understand your own finances and know what amount you are comfortable paying. I recommend getting at least 2 quotes from different lenders. Trust me, not all lenders are created equal, and being pre-approved by 2 lenders can help you for several reasons. Here are a few of the big reasons why you should get 2 pre-approvals. Lenders have rates that fluctuate. The lower lender today might be the higher one 6 months later. Not all lenders have the same closing costs. Some can be substantially higher than others. As I've stated above, not all lenders are created equal. Some have the skill and ability to solve problems, while others, like online lenders with great rates, will cave as soon as one thing goes wrong. If your loan falls apart, you don't want to start the entire pre-approval process over from scratch. You want to be able to jump right in with the backup lender, especially if you're using the loan to buy the property and have a limited escrow period. If a lender knows you are comparing them to someone else, they are more likely to give you a better rate or closing costs. Current rate. The rate the lender provides you with is based on that day's rates for the loan you are requesting. Be aware that this can change because interest rates fluctuate. Several factors affect mortgage interest rates, including demand of money, supply of money, the prime rate determined by the Federal Reserve System, the stock market's health, treasury bill rates. What does this mean for you? It means you don't expect the rate you're quoted to be the same rate you get on your loan. If rates go up, so will yours. If rates go down, well, make sure your lender is giving you the current rate and not the higher one they quoted you. If you want a better rate, ask the lender what you need to do to get it. Sometimes paying down a small credit card or improving a credit score by a few points can make a really big difference on your interest rate. Remember, if you're dealing with a portfolio lender or commercial lender, you can't expect the same rates as residential or standard loans. Most portfolio lenders also have adjustable rate mortgages, ARMs, or ARMs, that will track up and down with benchmark rates like the prime rate or Wall Street Journal rates. Seasoning period. The seasoning period refers to the period of time after you buy a property, but before you can take a loan on it. Many lenders don't want to finance something right after an investor buys it. This is because they want to make sure the property is stable, rented, and wasn't a fire sale situation. This is one of the methods lenders use to protect their investment. Asking a lender for the length of their seasoning period is crucial. You don't want to get involved in a project assuming you can take a loan on it 2 months after it's completed, just to find out later it has a 6-month seasoning period and you can't access your money until then. Different lenders have different seasoning periods, and different types of loans do as well. Portfolio lenders tend to have more flexibility with these periods, while conventional lenders often do not. ask this question up front to save yourself some time? In general, a shorter seasoning period is better for you, as it will increase the velocity of your money. If the lender quotes you a longer period, ask them if there's anything you can do to shorten it. Sometimes these periods are flexible based on the circumstances of the loan. In some cases, lenders just want to know the property is occupied by a tenant who is stable, and they assume it will take 6 months to get there. If you finish your rehab quickly and have a tenant in place, ask your lender if they can shorten the seasoning period for you. Loan to value. Your loan to value, LTV, percentage is a huge thing to find out right away because it has such a big impact on your ROI. The best lenders will have programs with a 75 to 80% LTV. Some of the mediocre ones will do 70%, and anything less than that is typically considered not ideal for investors. The higher LTV you can get, the more of your money you can get back out of a deal. This leads to higher ROIs and more money to invest later. This is the whole point of the BRRRR strategy, right? We want to start with the end in mind. Since this is the case, ask your lender right away what kind of LTV they are offering and only move forward with those who provide one that works for your goals. Some lenders have flexible LTVs, while others don't. Some lenders will offer you a higher LTV at a higher rate. Some lenders will even let you borrow the rehab cost along with the loan. Make sure you ask questions to dig deeper into why they are showing you a certain LTV, and if there are other options they aren't telling you about. Don't assume they are telling you everything, and don't even assume the lender you're talking to knows everything. In my experience, small businesses don't always do a good job training their employees. Most of the time, the leadership comes up with loan programs, rate sheets, and lending options that are not disseminated effectively, and the employee you are speaking with isn't aware of what the bank can do. Make it your responsibility to ask them exactly what you want to know, and if they aren't sure, ask them to find out. Closing costs. Closing costs are the fees associated with getting a loan. Let me tell you, they can be much higher than you expect. In my area of Northern California, we routinely see clients pay $7,000 to $10,000 in lender closing costs alone. This doesn't include title, escrow, taxes, or realtor fees, showing that closing costs on their own can be expensive. Closing costs is really a generic term used to encompass a whole lot of different fees. You want to ask for specifics when inquiring about this. In a transaction, closing costs will typically refer to lender closing costs, title closing costs, escrow closing costs, as well as taxes and fees. You want to ask the lender specifically about lender closing costs. Lender closing costs tend to be broken up into names like origination fees, underwriting fees, points, application fees, credit report costs, etc. Different lenders charge different fees for each type. Some lenders will try to bury their fees among all the other title, escrow, tax-related fees and tell you to expect 2% of the purchase price in closing costs. You don't want this. Ask for specifics. Many lenders are trained to quote you one specific closing cost. Say, for example, the origination fee. Don't get fooled by this. Ask for a net sheet or a list of all the closing costs you'll be paying and compare these costs between lenders. Many investors will haggle over $1,000 on the purchase price but pay $2,500 more for one lender than they would for the next. Don't be that person. Ask for this information up front. Rate buy-down, paying points. In some cases, lenders will offer you the option to buy down your interest rate. This is basically an opportunity for you to pay more in closing costs so you can get a better interest rate. Sometimes this is a good idea, sometimes it's not. My advice is to ask how much you'll have to spend to buy down the rate in dollars. Then look to see how long it will take for you to recoup that amount in loan savings. For instance, if you can spend $3,000 to buy down your rate to a point where it will save you $100 a month, it would take you 30 months to recoup your upfront expense of $3,000. $3,000 divided by $100 equals $30. If you plan on owning the property for more than 30 months and don't need that $3,000 for anything else, it might be a good idea to buy down that rate. Cash out refinance rates. Many new investors are surprised when they find out the interest rates on cash out refinances are higher than purchase refinances. Trust me, I've never understood this one either. Basically, lending institutions have decided that when someone is pulling cash out of a property, when the loan amount is higher than the current mortgage balance, the loan is riskier for the lender and therefore needs a higher interest rate to offset that risk. For us, as BRRRR investors, this isn't good. Since we are likely taking out a loan on a property that has no debt on it or a small amount of hard money debt on it, virtually all our refinances will be cash out refinances. So be sure to ask your lender what their rate is for cash out refinances, as they may be assuming you are getting pre-approved to purchase a house, not refinance one you've already purchased. Out-of-state investors. If you're looking to finance a property out of state, make sure you let the lender know this right away. Many lenders won't lend on properties when the owner lives out of state, as they are worried the owner is more likely to lose the property. Lots of misconceptions still exist about out-of-state investing, and many still believe it is riskier than it is. Oftentimes, you'll find yourself going to credit unions to find loan products that will work for an investor. Credit unions have rules about who can be members, and the location where the member lives is a big one. I've had cases where I thought I was approved for a loan, only to find out the credit union said no to the loan at the last minute when they heard I didn't live in their county. Learn from my mistakes and ask this question early on in the process. Portfolio lenders. Ask right away if the lender is a portfolio lender or if they plan on selling your loan after it's originated. If a lender is a portfolio lender, you can adjust your expectations up front that you won't be getting the low interest rates and terms that GSE, government-sponsored entity, loans usually have. You'll also realize this is a lender that would be a great asset to your business in the future. Portfolio lenders can make loans when other people can't, especially to real estate investors, so be nice to these people. You want to build a relationship with portfolio lenders, because as you grow your business, you'll use them over and over again. Because portfolio lenders are such a crucial element to the success of real estate investors, I've included a section on how to establish an incredible relationship with them. Relationship building advice with portfolio lenders. So how do you bring value to a relationship? That is a two-part process. 1. Understand the point of the relationship. What are you trying to get from it? 2. Understand the other person's position. What do you have that will benefit them? Now, before you jump in and tell me you should never get into a relationship wanting something from it, and you should only do what's good for other people without thinking about yourself, let me challenge that logic. If you really want to be honest with yourself, everything we do, we get something out of. You should do a good job at work, even if your boss isn't watching, right? But how long would you be working really hard at your job if they stopped paying you? If we are honest, even the most benevolent act we commit still makes us feel good when we do it. We get something out of everything we do. Wise people know they should bring value to every relationship, and honest people demand it of themselves. Black belt investors are very good at bringing value and are shrewd about who they bring that value to. Our time is limited. So is our energy. Making sure you get a good ROI with your time and energy is crucial to success. This means choosing the right people to invest in, just like choosing the right properties. If we know portfolio lenders can be a big help to our business, it stands to reason we should be developing relationships with the right ones. How do we do this? We ask ourselves step two of the two-part value-bringing process. Understand the other person's position. What do you have that will benefit them? If we want to bring value to a portfolio lender, just like anyone else, we need to understand what their job is, what is valuable to them, and how we can provide that. If you find the right one and you do a good job bringing value, you can establish a relationship that will last for a long time. Sending referrals. Portfolio lenders work for banks. Banks make money by bringing in deposits at a low interest rate, then providing loans with that money at higher interest rates. Lenders make money by making loans. If a lender isn't making loans, they aren't making money. This makes you, as a borrower, a lead to them. A lead in business is basically any contact or opportunity that could result in the desired goal of the person collecting that lead. For us as investors, a great potential deal is a lead. When we hear, "Hey, my neighbor is in money trouble and needs to sell his house fast. Here's his number." That number is a lead. Well, you as a borrower are a lead to a lender. Leads have value. Now, of course, not every lead becomes a deal. That neighbor might not have any equity in his house, or might not be that motivated after all. Borrower leads work the same way. You, as a lead, might not have a good enough credit score, debt-to-income ratio, or money in reserve to qualify for a loan. The key is, serious business people are always looking for leads. I know this because I am one, and I work with many. Whether it's a new client for my real estate business, or a new house to buy, or a new great contractor, I'm always looking for new leads. Sending your lender other people who are looking to buy properties is a way of providing them with value. Leads are valuable, and you providing leads is a way of providing value. It's a form of currency you can use to buy yourself into a deeper relationship with them. Providing a lender with leads of other investors or primary residence homeowners is a tactic to get yourself into their good graces and show them you are an asset. The next best thing you can ask them is what kind of leads they are looking for. Not every lender is looking for the same type of lead. Some lending institutions go through periods where they feel they are too exposed to residential real estate investment property and want to move more to the commercial side. Others prefer to work more with primary residence loans than with investor loans. Whatever the case, you need to ask these lenders exactly what kind of loans they are looking to provide, then tailor your search. Ask them to provide you with a sheet or some kind of marketing material you can spread around. Learn about their products so when someone asks you about them, you sound informed and educated. Showing these lenders you're working to make them money will motivate them to help you do the same. Bank deposit and loan cycles. Just like not all banks are looking to give out the same kinds of loans all the time, they are also not looking to give loans out during certain periods of their deposit cycle. If you want to help someone, you need to learn as much as possible about their industry, job, and responsibilities. Learning to help lenders means learning about banking cycles. When a bank or lending institution decides it wants to make loans, it charges a certain interest rate for the right to borrow their money. The difference in the interest rate the bank charges you and the interest they pay their customers to keep money at the bank is the profit they'll make. When a bank is looking to provide loans, you can usually tell from their marketing. Walking into a bank that wants to make loans is usually an experience where you're being hit by sign after sign advertising their low interest rates. When banks are overfunded, Their marketing is geared to pull in those who need to borrow money. Banks need to loan this money out, as they will slowly be losing money with all the interest they are paying to the customers who deposited funds if they don't. Conversely, if banks are advertising their high interest rates on deposits, they are usually in a fundraising stage, meaning they are low on money to lend out and want more to deposit. How does this help you to know? If you are approaching a bank looking for a loan when they are low on money to lend out, the odds of you getting the loan are much lower. So, should you just wait until they have more money to lend? Maybe. That is certainly an option. But what if you don't want to wait? Is that really all you can do, other than find a different lender? One thing that's worked for me in the past is to offer to keep my money on deposit with the institution if I'm turned down for a loan. This may seem odd to you, but it can work wonders. The following is a script I use if a lender tells me they can't do my loan, but can't quote any specific reason why I'm not eligible. Hello, Mr. Smith. I just wanted to thank you for your time earlier with reviewing my application and getting back to me so promptly. I understand you don't always get compensated with results like these, and I appreciate you treating me like a valued customer nonetheless. I also wanted to propose an alternative scenario. I understand your institution has determined it's not in their best interest to provide a loan I requested at this time. I wanted to know if it would make any difference to you and your bank if I put a sizable deposit of X amount of dollars in a savings account before funding the loan. My hope is for you to see I want a mutually beneficial relationship with you and your institution, and I understand and am willing to go the extra mile to establish that. Would you mind running this by the other parties involved in the decision and seeing if we could work something out under this new scenario? I hope to be banking with you all for a long period of time, and I'd love to know more about how to create a win-win situation for everyone. Thanks again for your time. I have used this script several times, and it's worked for me before. Banks aren't used to customers caring about their position or looking for ways to pitch in. I can almost guarantee emails like this will catch them off guard, as most people who are told no tend to walk off in a huff rather than look for a win-win solution. Credit unions are typically smaller institutions that are relationally based. They want to develop relationships with customers they can trust to pay back their loans. This is a large part of what their business model is based on. Offering to keep money on deposit with your lender is a way of starting off the relationship on the right foot and showing you care about their success just as much as you want them to care about yours. If you're applying for a loan at an institution that is relationship-based, this is likely to go a long way with them. You are speaking their love language in so many words. While this is one way to develop relationships, this isn't the only reason this method works. There is a logical component to it as well. When a bank is considering offering you a loan, they have to consider the opportunity cost of giving you the money, just like you have to consider it when choosing to buy one property over another. If a lender gives you a loan, they will make money on the closing costs. If the lender is low on funds, they will have the problem of not being able to lend this money to someone else. If that someone else is a high roller, valuable client, or person who has an expectation their loan will be filled, this can put the institution in a tough spot. You solve this problem by offering to put money on deposit with them. In addition to strengthening the relationship, it gives them capital to lend to someone else. When they are considering several different borrowers all applying for loans, yours will stand out since you're willing to put money on deposit with them. It makes your loan much more difficult to turn down and offers less risk for the bank. This is an underutilized and valuable strategy not enough people are talking about, because it doesn't apply to a large number of investors, and it involves a level of sophistication when it comes to understanding lending cycles not everyone has. There isn't a ton of content on building relationships with lenders, but it's a valuable tool to have in your tool belt if you're serious about building a big portfolio. If you want to start hearing yes instead of no, I would suggest considering working this into your strategy. How many loans can I have with your institution? Each lending institution is different and has different rules for how many loans they will allow any individual borrower to hold with them. This is designed to protect the institution from overexposure to one person and mitigate risk in case that one individual passes away, loses their job, files for bankruptcy, etc. It is one safeguard they use to avoid having too many eggs in one basket. This is not the same as the rule that any individual borrower cannot have more than 10 finance properties. That rule is specific to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac loans. It's important to check with the lender you're considering working with before getting into business with them. This is especially true if you're just getting into a new market. For instance, you may be applying for loans at 5 different banks. This process involves feeling them out, looking into their products, and seeing how responsive their customer service and systems are. During this process, it would be wise to ask if they have a limit on the number of loans any one person can have with them. If the first bank says there is no limit, the second bank says there is a limit of 10, and the third, fourth, and fifth all say there is a limit of 3, would it make sense to even consider 3, 4, and 5? Once you get rolling with your investing, you're going to want to know you have a well you can continue to return to when you have a lending need. It's not very efficient to get a system going with one lender, then have to stop and build an entire new one after your third property is purchased. Finding out upfront which bank will let you get the most loans is a resourceful method that will pay off in the long run. What is your institution's appetite for residential loans? For those unfamiliar with how banks operate, one loan operates the same as another loan. For those lending out the money, however, this is not the case. Banks don't consider all loans to be equal. Different banks make different returns and take on different risk based on the type of loans they provide. Some loans make money for the lender because of closing costs. Others have very low closing costs but higher interest rates. Some loans are risky and therefore more expensive, while others are very low risk for the bank and make them less of a return. Each bank is making different decisions on how they will lend and who they will lend to as leadership sets parameters for the lending division. It is leadership's job to determine where they believe the economy or local market to be heading and make the loans likely to benefit the most. Understanding the leadership position on this gives you a big advantage when it comes to knowing which institutions to put the most time into. Banks tend to take the kinds of loans they are giving out and classify them according to the collateral securing the loan. This is why they are referred to as car loans, HELOCs, home equity lines of credit, business loans, rental property loans, commercial loans, etc. The name of the loan usually refers to the asset the bank gets to take as collateral if the loan doesn't close. Banks will look at which of these types of loans are getting the best return versus the amount of risk they pose and make lending decisions based on their assessment. These assessments often get shared with the lenders during company meetings. Each bank meets at different times and with different frequency. Once you've established the appropriate rapport with the lender you think you'll be working with, it's a good idea to ask them what type of appetite the bank currently has for the types of loans you're interested in. Odds are, you'll be looking for residential investment property. If the bank feels they are overexposed in that area, or doesn't like the fundamentals of that particular market, you may find yourself barking up the wrong tree. If you can find out from your lender when the bank's leadership will be meeting, you can ask them to make a request during the meeting to find out what types of loans the leadership committee is looking for. If they want to limit their exposure to investment properties, this isn't the right time to be working hard on a relationship with that institution. You want to find a bank that wants to give out more residential loans, or better yet, has special programs in place to keep the costs and fees low on these products. Taking a few extra steps to learn more about the lender you plan to work with can go far for you and your business. You have to be careful not to pry too much in the initial stages of getting to know them, but once you do, it can be beneficial to know what kinds of loans they want to give and how you can ultimately help the lender reach their sales goals. Providing value in this way is one way to incentivize them to want to do the same for you, and that's how valuable business relationships are built. Key points. Find the lender first. Get pre-approved. Know your lender's seasoning period. Ask about closing costs. Send referrals to anyone you want to win over. Find banks at the part in their lending cycle where they have money they need to lend out. Know your lending institution's appetite for residential loans. Chapter 9. The Value in Financing. It is much easier to put existing resources to better use than to develop resources where they do not exist. George Soros. Loan to value versus loan to cost. Loan to value, LTV, and loan to cost, LTC, are two terms used in the lending industry to describe the amount of money a lender will let you borrow relative to the value of the collateral. Put in more practical terms, the LTV is the amount of money they will let you borrow against the value of the property, and the LTC is the amount of money they will let you borrow against the total amount you invested in a property. Here is a quick example to demonstrate. Loan to value. You BRRRR a property that is appraised for $120,000. The bank will let you borrow 75% LTV. This means they will let you borrow $90,000, $120,000, times 0.75 equals $90,000, as they are letting you borrow against the appraised value of the property. Loan to cost. You BRRRR a property and spend $90,000 total between the acquisition and the rehab. The property appraises for $120,000. The bank will let you borrow 75% LTC. This means they will let you borrow $67,500. $90,000 times 0.75 equals $67,500, as they are letting you borrow against the total amount of money you put into the deal. As I'm sure you can see, there is a big, big difference between the end results of $90,000 and $67,500. When you consider that the BRRRR model is most effective when repeated over and over, the impact of the difference is compounded even more. The difference of $22,500 is a significant amount of capital, and it's the reason why we try our best to look for lenders that will lend against the value of a property, not the cost. When reaching out to find the lender you want to pre-approve you, make sure you ask right away if they lend against the value or the cost. If they tell you they lend against the cost, they had better have a really high percentage, like 95%. In essence, they are telling you there is a 0% chance you will be able to pull out more than you've invested, or even all that you've invested. For this reason, I avoid banks that will only let me borrow LTC. The reason I avoid LTC is because my strategy involves adding as much value as I possibly can to a project before pulling money out. As I've mentioned, my goal is to add lots of equity to a deal before I refinance it. Equity grows wealth quickly. At this state in my investing career, I want to grow and grow fast. But what if that's not where you are? What about if you're looking to buy properties and refinance them, but you aren't trying to maximize the value before doing so? There are many reasons why this might make sense. Pushing your property to its limit before refinancing is a lot of work. It's also a lot of stress. There is a lot more communication with contractors, a lot more thought and research that goes into the deal, a lot more variables where things can go wrong. For some investors, this just isn't worth the headache. In instances where you're not trying to increase the value a great deal before refinancing, using the LTC won't be that different from LTV. You may ask why someone would use the BRRRR strategy in instances where they aren't adding big value to the property. That's a good question, and it's true that BRRRR is much less effective in these cases. However, some people purchase properties with cash simply because they can get a better deal that way. Cash offers are more appealing to sellers, and it's one way that buyers can get themselves a better deal even if they don't plan on a massive rehab. There is something to be said for buying a property, having a smooth rehab, then refinancing when you're finished. If capital isn't an issue for you, then using an LTC model won't necessarily have such an adverse impact on your bottom line. The main reason for using an LTV model is to recover more of the money you put in. So if this isn't a concern of yours, LTC can work just fine. Different types of loan products. When looking into financing a home, you may have heard different loan names get thrown around. For most of us not involved in the lending industry, it's easy to get confused by this. Throw in the fact that nobody likes looking ignorant, and odds are you aren't likely to ask somebody what these names even mean. FHA, VA, conventional, jumbo, etc. If you've ever wondered what the differences are between all these loans, I'll teach you what they mean and how to know which option is best for you. Keep in mind, as you read this, the vast majority of loans are made for borrowers looking to finance their primary residence. With this being the case, only a handful of most loans are options for those buying or financing investment property. Conventional. A conventional loan is basically the generic home loan. Conventional loans offered by lenders are typically insured by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, meaning the government is insuring part of your loan so lenders are more willing to give them out. When a lender originates a loan, the vast majority of them then sell this loan to someone else on the secondary market. If the loan is government insured, it is much easier to find a lender who will buy the loan from the originator. Conventional loans are what the majority of real estate investors will start off using. Although you can find conventional loans for as little as 3, 5, or 10% down, these are products only offered to those buying a house as their primary residence. If you're looking to purchase a rental property, you'll need to put a minimum of 20% down, and sometimes 25%. Keep in mind, most lenders classify conventional loans in three categories: primary residence, vacation or second home, and investment property. Investment properties are considered the riskiest and therefore have the highest interest rates of all three. Vacation homes are slightly better rates than investment property, and primary residences come with the best rates and terms of all three. FHA. FHA stands for Federal Housing Administration. This is the department of the federal government that is involved in providing fair housing for all Americans, as well as other duties. An FHA-insured loan is a U.S. Federal Housing Administration mortgage insurance-backed mortgage loan, which is provided by an FHA-approved lender. FHA-insured loans are a type of federal assistance and have historically allowed lower-income Americans to borrow money for the purchase of a home that they would not otherwise be able to afford. As I'm sure you've already guessed, FHA loans are only for primary residence homeowners. They typically provide for much lower down payments and lower credit scores, but come with other caveats. FHA loans currently have mortgage insurance payments that exist for the lifetime of the loan. This means if you take out an FHA loan, you'll have to refinance completely to get rid of the mortgage insurance. Otherwise, you'll be paying it for the life of the loan. VA. VA loans are insured by the Department of Veterans Affairs. They are offered for service members of our nation's military. VA loans provide great value for those eligible to use them. VA loans allow for 0% down, letting the borrower borrow 100% of the property's value. They also come with no mortgage insurance, a big savings over time. The downside of VA loans is they are notorious for being more difficult than conventional loans to close. Experienced listing agents know that VA loans have stricter guidelines than conventional loans. Additionally, VA loans have a reputation for ending up with low appraisals. If a property doesn't appraise at value, there is a high likelihood it will fall out of escrow or the buyer will demand the seller to lower the price, especially if the buyer is expecting to put 0% down. For this reason, many listing agents look to avoid VA loans unless they have no other option. Jumbo. A jumbo loan is a term used by lenders to describe a high-balance loan. Each housing market, usually divided by county, has a limit placed on it. Any borrower looking to borrow more money than the limit in place is considered higher risk, and with that comes less favorable terms. High-balance loan limits differ by area and can sometimes be substantially more or less than neighboring areas. This is rarely an issue for investors, as we are typically investing in C-class areas, areas where the average home is at the median home price or below. Most investors don't make money buying at the top of a market, so jumbo loans don't come up much for us. Be aware that if you ever want to buy a property that requires a jumbo loan, you'll likely be paying a higher interest rate, more lender fees, and may need a higher interest rate to qualify. Portfolio. Portfolio loans are made by a lender who doesn't plan on selling them on the secondary market, hence keeping them in their own portfolio. These loans are typically offered by credit unions and savings and loan institutions as perks for their members. If you want to finance more than 10 properties, you'll want to learn how these loans work. Currently, you can't have a conventional loan on more than 10 financed properties. Because they aren't sold on the secondary market, the terms of a portfolio loan are not as favorable as those that are. These loans are not insured by the government, and that makes them riskier to the lender. If you're looking into a portfolio loan, be prepared to see adjustable rate mortgages and higher interest rates than you're used to. Most portfolio lenders I see are offering a 5-to-1 adjustable rate mortgage. This means the loan will be made at a set interest rate for 5 years, then can adjust every year after that by a certain amount specified in the loan documents. Developing relationships with institutions that will give portfolio loans is a crucial part of growing your portfolio over 10 properties. Hard money. Hard money loans are those made by a private lender that are secured by a hard asset. Because these loans are not guaranteed by the federal government and not intended to be for long periods of time, they typically have very high interest rates and fees. Hard money lenders are primarily used by house flippers or investors looking for a bridge loan to get them into a property and then later refinance into a more stable loan. Hard money loans are often used to purchase property that would not qualify for conventional financing. Because hard money loans tend to be so much riskier than normal loans, they are used for risky deals like flips and rehab projects. The cost of these loans is very high. Lenders need to protect their investment, and they understand if the borrower defaults, they are likely taking back a property in terrible disrepair that cannot be easily sold. It's not uncommon in my area to see hard money loans given at terms of 14% interest and 4 points. A point is 1% of the amount of the loan, so 4 points would be 4% of the loan amount. Not cheap. Owner financing. Owner financing is when the owner of a property agrees to be the bank and hold a mortgage note against their property. This is often used for real estate investors who can't qualify for any more loans but still want to buy more property. In the case of owner financing, the borrower will usually offer the seller some form of down payment, and then the seller will finance the remaining balance of the purchase price. In these cases, the borrower will make payments to the seller based on the loan agreement. The owner holds a mortgage note secured by property itself and can foreclose on the borrower or perform what is basically an eviction in states with land contracts if the borrower fails to make the agreed-upon payment. Owner financing is a creative solution for those who can't qualify for conventional or portfolio loans but still want to buy properties. private financing. Private financing is when one individual lends money to another. In the case of real estate investing, this is usually done for the purpose of buying or financing investment property. Private financing can be short-term, as in the case of flips, or long-term, as in the case with mortgage notes. In most cases, private financing is a better alternative than hard money. The best investors have large pools of private financing to draw from and do so successfully to continue their investing endeavors long after they have committed all their own capital to real estate investing. HELOC. HELOC stands for Home Equity Line of Credit. HELOCs are loans given against the equity in a property. They are second-place mortgages that are usually cheap and incredible opportunities to get money to invest with at a low rate. HELOCs function just like credit cards, but with very low interest rates. Credit cards carry high interest rates because the debt is unsecured, meaning there is no collateral. This makes these loans much riskier for the lender. A HELOC is secured by a property, making it much less risky and therefore much cheaper for the borrower. HELOCs function like a line of credit. You only pay for money you have borrowed against the line, and when you pay that money back, you don't owe any more. Lines tend to stay open for a 10 to 15 year period. After this draw period is over, you have to either pay the balance in full or, in some cases, the balance converts to a traditional amortized loan in which you will make payments of principal and interest. The size of the line of credit is based on the amount of equity in your property. 80-10-10. An 80-10-10 loan isn't really a loan, but more a way of structuring two loans together, usually for the purpose of avoiding mortgage insurance for borrowers who don't have 20% to put down. Mortgage insurance is usually required by borrowers who don't have 20% to put down on their property, 80% LTV, because this makes the loan riskier. For those without 20% equity, lenders force borrowers to pay for mortgage insurance to protect the lender in the case of default. An 80-10-10 loan is a way of combining two loans together to avoid this. It's basically stating the property will be funded by 1. A first loan at 80% of the property's value, 2. A second loan at 10% of the property's value, 3. A 10% down payment. For borrowers who have a 10% down payment, they can avoid mortgage insurance by taking out a second mortgage against the property for 10% of the property's value. This second mortgage covers the extra 10% the borrower did not have and allows the first mortgage, the one that would have required mortgage insurance, to only be for 80% of the value. This second mortgage is usually a HELOC, and HELOCs don't require mortgage insurance. Which types of loans work for investors? As I've stated above, investors can't use FHA or VA loans, at least not for the purchase of a property. If you want to use these loans for investment property, you have to be clever about how you go about it. Remember, loan guidelines are related to the purchase of a property. They aren't necessarily made to govern the use of a property after it's purchased. If you'd like more advice on how to use one of these loans to help you get started investing in real estate, speak with a lender or legal counsel. I do know that I've seen investors buy properties with a VA or FHA loan and later rent them out when they moved into a different property, and I'm not aware of any laws or regulations prohibiting this. Using low down payment loans to buy what will eventually be an investment property is very similar to the way the BRRRR method works, without needing the cash up front. You are significantly lowering the amount of money you're putting into a deal. That is the key to increasing your ROI. Another way to accomplish this would be to use hard money or private money to buy a property. Once purchased, you can either use more hard or private money to finance the rehab work, or you can use your own cash. Once the rehab is completed and the value has been raised, you refinance into a conventional or portfolio loan and voila! You get the lion's share of your money back and increase your ROI substantially. A final and epic way to take advantage of FHA or VA financing when it comes to investment property is to house hack. House hacking is a term first coined by Brandon Turner. It refers to finding creative ways to get someone else to pay your mortgage. This can be accomplished in many ways, but there are two that are easier and more common than all the others. They are get roommates. A very underrated way to buy an investment property and own it for free is to use an FHA or VA loan, or a 3-5% down conventional loan, to buy a property, then rent the rooms out to others who pay you to use them. If you do this right, you can often get your entire mortgage paid, or even more. Having others make the payments while you build equity and eventually cash flow is a simple and effective way to get started in real estate investing. It also allows you to take advantage of the best loans at your disposal relatively easily. Buy a small multifamily. As I mentioned earlier, 2-4 unit properties are still considered single-family loans to lenders. What does this mean to you? It means you can use a loan to buy one of these homes as your primary residence, put very little money down, and still end up with an investment property that provides you with a significant ROI. Buying a 2-, 3-, or 4 unit property allows you to rent out the units you aren't living in and use that rent money to reduce the amount you owe toward your own mortgage. If you combine this with the first method, get roommates, you can increase your cash flow even more. Imagine buying a fourplex, renting out 3 of the units, then renting out a bedroom or 2 in the unit you live in. That's a lot of cash flow for little money down. The story of Insightful Ivan. Insightful Ivan was aptly named. From the time he was a young boy, Ivan was always able to find the silver lining in a storm cloud. When other young children would complain about the snacks their mothers packed in their lunch that they didn't like, Ivan learned to trade these snacks to other kids and get something better. When other children complained about the basketball referees calling too many fouls, Ivan learned to adjust his game to the referee's style and got an advantage over the other players. Ivan was shrewd, wise, insightful, and willing to work. His motto was always, do more with less. Ivan began listening to podcasts like Bigger Pockets at age 19. He instantly became hooked listening to the co-hosts share ways they had built their wealth coming from humble beginnings. This was exactly the type of content Ivan was drawn to. He didn't take handouts, so it was up to Ivan to make it in the world if that's what he wanted to do. Ivan became determined to do everything he could and everything that was within his realm of possibility to make that happen. One day while listening to the podcast, Ivan heard the story of an investor who had built major equity for himself by house hacking. As Ivan listened more intently, his face lit up as bright as the light bulb he felt appearing above his head. Of course! All this time, Ivan had been thinking he needed to save 20% to put down on a house. This is what everyone had always said. Oh, how wrong he had been. Ivan listened as the guest explained how he bought a fourplex for $300,000 with a 5% conventional loan. Each unit had 2 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, and 900 square feet. The units were individually metered for electric and water. The investor then rented out 3 of the units for $750 each. Ivan listened in amazement as the investor explained the numbers. With a mortgage payment of $1,529.94, property tax of $312.50, insurance and mortgage insurance of $260, and utilities, sewer, garbage, and landscaping for $150, his total monthly payment came to $2,252.44. The investor then explained how he had previously been paying $750 a month to rent the apartment he had been living in. After buying the fourplex, the investor rented out one of the two bedrooms in the unit he lived in to a buddy from work for $450 a month. If we break down the investor's total income, it looks like this. Three units, each at $750 per month, plus the unit four-bedroom at $450, equals a total of $2,700 per month. The investor was careful to explain he was managing the property himself and doing all the repairs himself. Ivan realized this wouldn't work for him, as he was not handy, so he'd have to budget for outside help. Just as Ivan was beginning to think this could work for him, the investor shared the ROI on the property he was living in. Income is $2,700. Expenses are $2,252.44. Cash flow is $447.56. Total invested, $15,000 down plus $6,000 closing costs, is $21,000. Yearly cash flow, $447.56 times 12 months, is $5,370.72, which makes the ROI, yearly cash flow divided by total invested, 25.57%. Ivan was blown away. How on earth was someone achieving a return of over 25% and living somewhere for free? This house hacking thing seemed too good to be true. As he turned over the possibilities in his mind, Ivan realized something the investor had not shared. Not only was the investor making 25%, but he was also avoiding the rent of $750 he had been paying before. Ivan pulled out his calculator and did some quick math. If he added the rent the investor was no longer paying, $750, to the income already being collected, $2,700, the new amount was actually $3,450. This was a more accurate depiction of how much the property was generating for the investor, as he was now living there and saving an extra $750 he had previously been spending. Ivan checked out the new numbers. New income equals $3,450. Expenses equal $2,252.44. Cash flow equals $1,197.56. Total invested equals $15,000 down plus $6,000 closing costs, $21,000. Yearly cash flow equals $1,197.56 times 12, $14,370.72. ROI equals $14,370.72 divided by $21,000, 68.4%. Ivan was astonished. If he factored in the rent the investor was now saving, the ROI skyrocketed to 68%. This was not including principal paydown, the equity in the deal at the time of purchase, or the tax savings owning real estate can bring. This investor had saved up $21,000 and was now earning the equivalent of nearly 70% on that money while owning an asset likely to appreciate, with rents also likely to appreciate, over time. Insightful Ivan knew exactly what he needed to do. The next day he sold his Camaro and bought a used Civic. Ivan looked at his budget and found ways to cut unnecessary expenses like cable, eating out, and buying new clothes. Ivan knew what he wanted to do, and he put a plan together to achieve it. Now that Ivan knew what kind of fouls the financial referees were calling, he was darn sure he would learn to play this new kind of game, and he'd build massive wealth to do so. To leverage or not to leverage? That is the question. At its core, the Burr method does two things great. 1. It recovers capital. 2. It increases ROI. By recovering more of your capital, you reduce your investment basis in a property, and that increases your ROI. That's how the investor in the above example achieved such stellar returns. You also recover the ability to buy more properties and earn a higher return on those properties as well. If neither of these factors is important to you, the traditional model will work just fine. So how do you know if you should be trying to recover capital and use the Burr method? My guess is, if you've read this far into the book already, you are hungry to grow your wealth and you want to find ways to do that faster, wiser, and more efficiently. To Burr well is to do everything with insight and plan for what you want. Burr investors don't leave things up to chance. They go after what they want. So why am I such a huge fan of leverage? While I will always believe in the power of leverage to achieve more, I find it to be uniquely suited to capitalize on leverage when it comes to real estate investing. Whether it's leveraging time, money, resources, knowledge, or more, many investors have already found ways to incorporate other people or resources into their business to help them scale faster. Below are some reasons I think investors should be considering more leverage. Other people's money. If you're going to be a serious investor, you had better get used to both the phrase and the concept of OPM. OPM, or other people's money, is used to describe the concept of building your wealth off of, you guessed it, other people's money. Now, to be fair, OPM has received a lot of negative press because shady people use this concept not as a way to grow everyone's wealth, but as a way to defer risk to someone else. For the purpose of my advice and this discussion, I am never referring to deferring risk as a benefit of OPM. If you wouldn't do it with your own money, you should not be doing it with someone else's. Now, the right way of using OPM is that it benefits both parties. You see, real estate investing requires three things to be successfully done. 1. Money or capital. 2. Knowledge. 3. Hustle or work. The bad news is you can't make it happen without all three. The good news is, you don't need to do all three yourself. Finding someone else to supply one or two of the three allows you to do several things that will increase your own success. 1. Allows you to focus on sharpening your own skills. 2. Allows you to avoid the things you're not great at. 3. Allows you to increase the volume of deals you're doing. 4. Allows you to specialize in one thing, avoiding the jack of all trades, master of none trap. 5. Allows you to take